Just like to mention before we begin the shiur this evening, for those of you that not yet heard, Baruch Hashem, about a week and a half ago we had a baby boy. His name is Yonah Chaim, and as I was holding him this afternoon within the course of the preparation of the shiur, it occurred to me that if he could only cast his mind back a couple of weeks, he could have been of invaluable assistance. But things being what they were, he wasn't very forthcoming, and I had to look everything up. So we open Parsha Shoftim, having spent the weeks of the break with the very heavy Parshas of Vayeschana and Ekev and Re'eh. But before we come to discuss matters within the Parsha, I'd like to devote some remarks to something that has begun yesterday and will accompany us throughout the month of Elul, and that is the Tkiyas Shofar, the minhag of blowing the shofar, which is universally accepted when it comes to slichas. Ashkenazim are not as early as the Sfardim, but everyone hears the shofar from Rosh Chodesh Elul until the day before Rosh Hashanah. And it's worthwhile pondering what exactly the sound of the shofar is meant to be doing for us during this month. We're of course mindful of the fact that in a month's time there will be a mitzvah from the Torah to blow the shofar, Yom Teruah Yelachem, on Rosh Hashanah. But we are a month before, we're bringing the mitzvah early, it seems. What are we doing? Are we practicing? Bedera klal, mitzvahs that are a month in advance, we don't practice them. We don't practice eating matzah a month before Pesach or shaking lulav a month before Sukkot. If anything, it's the opposite. We eschew matzah before we come to chew it when the time comes. And yet here, shofar, we don't avoid it during the month of Elul so that we can hear it b'teyavon on Rosh Hashanah, but rather we blow every day. We are, of course, aware that the shofar has a call to tshuva, and tshuva is very much of the essence during these days of Elul. But still, if we could get a more crystallized understanding of the sound of the shofar, it might give it much more meaning for us. In many places, the shofar blowing during Elul doesn't—I don't think it's the ma'amad that it deserves. It's a kind of a yotzei zayin almost. Everyone's halfway out, and someone has to blow the shofar. And normally, the first person who's offered the shofar refuses and gives it to somebody else. So finally, Sabach, who he's at the end of the line, so he tries his hand, and it can be sometimes an excruciating experience to hear him try and blow the shofar. Perhaps there's kapara savonus in that experience itself. But that is not what the shofar blowing of Elul is meant to be about. The source of blowing the shofar during Elul is very early, at least what it is based on. It's in one of the oldest collections of Midrashim that we have, the Pirkei Rabbi Elazar, in Perek Mem Vav. And the Pirkei Rabbi Elazar explains that the first time the shofar was ever blown on Rosh Chodesh Elul was the first of Elul that Moshe went up on Har Sinai for the third time. The first time, of course, ended in disaster at Shivasa B'Tammuz, and then according to Rashi, there was a middle set of 40 days, and then the final set of 40 days begins with Rosh Chodesh Elul and ends with Yom Kippur, of course. And the Pirkei Elazar explains that when Moshe went up the mountain, they sounded the shofar in order to announce and make everyone aware that Moshe, he'll be back. You won't see him for the next few days because he's going up to Har Sinai. And the point of the exercise is, don't do anything advised when he's not there. Not like the first time that he went to get the Luchos and you thought that he went missing and you made the Egel. Don't repeat that mistake. That's what the sound of the shofar is for. And based on this, says the Torah, we blow the shofar from Rosh Chodesh Elul. The first shofar blowing is a zecher, so to speak, for the sound of the shofar when Moshe went up to receive the second set of luchos. Now, these words still need to be pondered, because we may ask, in its time, it was of the essence. When Moshe was absent, they needed to know where he was and that he would be back. But we don't have Moshe going up the mountain every year since. We have Rosh Hashanah every year since, and we have Yom Kippur every year since, but this specific experience, we don't have. Why then do we need to hear that Moshe is going up the mountain in subsequent years? Is it a zecher? Well, what's the point of a zecher? Generally speaking, the things that we do that are zecher, for things that were, are things that we are anticipating will return. I mean, when you think about it, all the things that we do, korech is zecher lemikdash kehillel, and we take lulav and esrog for all 7 days, zecher lemikdash, we remember them because we're looking forward to having them again. But we're not looking forward to Moshe receiving another set of luchos in some elul in the future. So this zecher seems to be not rooted in the present and even not in the future. So what are we doing by remembering the past? Especially as there is no zecher for Moshe coming down from Har Sinai with the second set of luchos, which arguably is more of the essence. We have the legacy of Moshe's coming down, and we have the Torah back again, and the second set of luchos, that's a much more lasting effect. Nothing that we do on Yom Kippur, as far as I'm aware, is a zecher for Moshe coming down from Har Sinai with the second set of luchos. So why is there a zecher for him going up and not going down? Secondly, as we know, and the Torah himself discusses this, we do not blow the shofar only on the first of Elul. We blow the shofar every day during Chodesh Elul. But Moshe didn't go up the mountain on the second or the third or and so on and so forth. Why then do we blow the shofar for all the days of Elul? And here if we say, which is fair to say, well, the shofar, it is a call to tshuva, but that itself begets an interesting question. If we blow the shofar during these days as a call to tshuva, it's interesting to consider why we don't blow the shofar after Rosh Hashanah, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That week is the Aseres Yimei Tshuva. Where is the shofar calling for tshuva? It is true that the Torah quotes another pasuk, famous pasuk from the Navi, in Yitaka Shofar Ba'ir, the Ha'am Lo Yecharadu, can the shofar be sounded in the city and people will not know, which seems to endorse the blowing of the shofar every day, but then, in a sense, we're left with two seemingly unrelated reasons for blowing the shofar. We began with remembering Moshe when he went up on Har Sinai, which only explained to us one day, and perhaps not even that. And then we moved over to the general idea of people tremble when they hear the sound of the shofar. How do these two go together? I mean, they seem to be working somehow in tandem with the other. So these are some preliminary questions to consider. It's also interesting to note, we know from Rashi, what was the nature of the mistake that we made the first time round? When Moshe went up to Har Sinai, and we thought he wasn't coming back. Of course, there's the Medrash that the Satan showed Moshe's coffin, and that clearly didn't help things. But Rashi tells us that actually there was a misunderstanding between Moshe and the people as to how exactly to reckon the 40 days. When do they start, and when do they stop? How can there be a misunderstanding? 40 is 40. Except the point is, says Rashi, that on the day that Moshe went up, that day was not part of the Cheshbon. Why not? Because 40 days need to be 40 complete days. If Moshe goes up to Har Sinai in the morning, that means that that can't be day one, because the evening of that day, he was yet here. So the first day, when he actually went up, is not part of the 40. So Moshe was planning on coming down 40 days, not counting the day he went up. The Jewish people, apparently unaware of this, did count the day he went up, and that's why their count of 40 ended a day before Moshe's count of 40. They thought the time was up, Moshe's not here, and they didn't realize that they started counting a day early. Now, and these are well-known words of Rashi, it's from the Medrash, but what then becomes a very interesting question is, if that's the nature of the mistake, how is it remedied by sounding the shofar when Moshe goes up the first time? In other words, everyone's there, and they sound the shofar as if to say, everyone should, pardon the expression, take note. Moshe is going up Har Sinai. Do not make the same mistake you made the first time around. They could still make the same mistake, because the heart of the matter has not been addressed. Is that 40 days including today, or not including today? Everyone knew when Moshe went up the first time around, it didn't stop them making a mistake. So laying such emphasis on awareness of Moshe going up, it doesn't seem to be protecting against repeating exactly the same mistake. Maybe they'll count the first day, and they'll nochamol finish 40 beforehand. So after all that, we seem to have not really addressed the root of the issue. The truth is, on a number of occasions, just reflect these words of Rashi, and again they're sourced in the Medrash, it's painfully ironic that the Chet HaEgel, to which we ascribe and which we see as the cataclysmic event that changed the course of Jewish history and world history from that point on, was the product of a misunderstanding. There's no way, it's never going to be a positive occasion, it's always going to be a tragedy, but the tragedy is almost unbearable to ponder when we consider that it could have been avoided with three extra words. Had Moshe gone up the first time and said, I'll be back after 40 days, that's what he said. Had he only added the words, not including today, none of this would have happened. So why didn't Moshe say it? Perhaps he thought that it was obvious. Well, apparently it wasn't obvious. Those are three words that could have gone a long way. And the vacuum of those three words echoes, we may say, until today. So what are we to make of this? An honest misunderstanding. It's almost too much to bear. Well, to get a bit of a further insight into the first day, it is part of the count, it's not part of the count, to get a bit of a deeper appreciation of what's behind that. So let's remind ourselves of something we've mentioned on a number of occasions. It's discussed at length in the writings of the Hafla, Reb Pinchas Halevi Horowitz, one of the Rebbes of the Chasam Sofer, in his Pirush on the Torah, Ponim Yofos, in Parshas Noach. And there the Hafla says that we all know, anyone who knows a luach knows that in Judaism, in Torah, how is the day configured? The night comes before the day. Says the Hafla, that is true, and it's part of Torah, but it is only true from the time of giving of the Torah. When the Torah came down to us, it came down with a new way of configuring the day, which you could argue is not the intuitive way to configure the day. Those that don't subscribe to Torah do not naturally reckon the day that way. And neither did the Jewish people, or the pre-Jewish people, before Matan Torah. And this is a very interesting discussion. It made waves, and there is a literature about it, and there are responses, and it's a whole sugya. The roots, actually, without getting too much into the details, but the roots of this approach of the Hafla could be perceived within the commentary of the Rashbam, who's already of the Rishonim, in Bereishis Perek Aleph. His explanation of the words Vayerev Vayuvoker, which would seem to be very clearly first comes Erev and Boker, actually support the Hafla. At Erev and Boker constituted the end of the first day. With daybreak came the culmination of day one, and day two began. So that's quite a statement. And based on this approach, we can perhaps say in a more nuanced way that when the Jewish people failed to discard the first day that Moshe went up on account of the fact that it wasn't a full day, because the night, the preceding night had already passed, it's not merely that they didn't think of that, or they didn't consider it. It's more a fact that they hadn't yet gotten used to counting days that way. Before Matan Torah, actually, the first day would be, the day that Moshe went up would be the first day, because if he goes up in the morning, it's a complete day. And as of a couple of months ago, or actually more accurately, as of a couple of days ago, that's what the day is. And Moshe goes up on the 7th of Sivan, 2 days ago, and the 5th of Sivan, that's a full day. It starts in the morning. So it's the Jewish people had not yet updated their schedules. They hadn't yet acclimatized to the new way of counting a day. But this doesn't yet make things any easier for us, because what's behind all of this? One of the great darshanim of pre-war times, Rabbi Yosef Nechemia Kornitzer of Krakow, and these are sfarim that I'm only aware of because they're in my father's Atzal's library, and he discusses the question generally. What are the implications, what's the meaning, the significance of counting, starting the day in the evening or in the morning? What does it mean? Is it to be dafka, just to be different than everybody else? So Rabbi Yosef Nechemia says that the question of how you rate the day, how you reckon the beginning of the day, is ultimately an expression of how you view life. Because life can be viewed in temporal terms, life can be viewed in more spiritual and elevated terms. In temporal terms, in physical terms, the day really does come before the night. I mean, life begins in the daytime when a person is young, physically, he's got his health, and he's got no worries, and he's got his drive, and he's got his strength, and he's got everything. And as life progresses, that begins to recede. In physical terms, the day begins with daylight, and things get darker. And if you're inclined to view the physical aspect of life as primary, that's how you'll count the day. I mean, life is made up of days. That for you is a day. In spiritual terms, it's the opposite. As much as the younger like to feel otherwise, and they begin in darkness. They have no wisdom, they have no maturity, they have no experience. And that develops. And therefore there's actually a crossover within physical and spiritual terms as life progresses. If from one point of view, darkness, light gets darker, and from the other point of view, dark gets lighter. It really, the critical question is, where do you lay emphasis? What for you is it all about? And with this in mind, we can get a deeper insight as to why it is that the way to calculate the days changed with the giving of the Torah. Before Torah enters into the world, with all the goodwill in the world, it's primarily physical, and the day is reckoned accordingly. And even for us, the day starts in the daytime and ends in the night. I mean, that's the dominant aspect of life. But when Torah comes into the world, and when Torah comes to the Jewish people, a new emphasis comes, a new focus comes. Spirituality is now the center. And that is reflected in the way that we begin to count the days differently. Now the day begins in the evening, and it will end with light the following morning. Following morning as daylight continues. And therefore, when we come to consider the mistake, the misunderstanding of the Jewish people, Moshe goes up in the morning. Is that morning and following afternoon, is that day one? Is it a complete day or no? We've seen Moshe discards it because the night has already passed. It's not a full day. Moshe is already counting the days in a Torah way. When the Jewish people have not yet updated the way they relate to the days, it's not merely a question of timing. It means that they are not yet fully on board with the message that the Torah brings by telling you to count the days differently. As if to say, they're still hanging on to the values to a certain degree that they had before Matan Torah. They're reluctant to part with the way that they used to count the days. And therefore, it's in a sense, it's not la'inyan for Moshe to announce not including today. That itself is part of the nisayon for the Jewish people on this occasion. Moshe says, I'm going up to Har Sinai. Do you understand what that means? You should. And if you don't, telling you is not going to help you. That's what's behind the misunderstanding. Certain misunderstandings are not the product of an honest mistake. Sometimes even misunderstandings are the product of a dishonest mistake. That means that although it was a mistake for the Jewish people not to realize that the first day wasn't part of the count, it was a mistake that they could have and should have avoided. I mean, that's what's receiving the Torah. And moreover, if we take things one step further, at the end of these 40 days, the Jewish people made the Egel. The making of the Egel is just another installment of the very same mistake of not knowing how to count the 40 days. As the Pasuk itself says, it always talks about the Jewish people having been taken out of Mitzrayim. Asher etzeisam eretz Mitzrayim, the Medrash tells us, they still have an affinity towards the things that they saw in Mitzrayim. I mean, they'll default back to them. That affinity that they have to those values of Mitzrayim that resulted in the Egel at the end of the 40 days also resulted in counting in a faulty way at the beginning of the 40 days. They still hang on to the pre-Matan Torah value system to a certain degree. So this is it's a new vista, really, and it at least rescues the mistake of not counting the first day correctly from being just a simple misunderstanding. It was far from simple. It's what Matan Torah is all about. And from here, let us come to consider the shofar. The Rambam, famously in Hilchos Tshuva, it's pointed out, not in Hilchos Shofar, in Hilchos Tshuva, in Perek Gimel Halacha Dalet, the Rambam says, Afalpi sheh tkias shofar gzeiras haTorah. Even though the blowing of the shofar, ultimately, no one really knows why we blow the shofar. Many a drasha has been propounded on the shofar, and hopefully all to good effect. But you never know. The only thing you know is the Torah said to blow the shofar, and that's the ultimate answer. Nonetheless, says Rambam, Mikol Mokom, Remez Yeshbo. There is an illusion in the blowing of the shofar, and of course Rambam says the illusion is Ur Yeshenim Mishen Aschem, wake up, those who are sleeping, wake up, Vinir Domim, Hakitzim Itadim Aschem, those who are slumbering, wake up from your slumber, and think about things, and think about what you're doing, and remember Hashem, and it's as surely as physically the sound wakes one up, well, the property of the shofar is deeper than that. And it has the capacity to wake up other aspects of the person. And this brings us really to the question of what it means to be asleep. I mean, what is the measure of the sleep that we're trying to wake up from? When we think of someone who's sleeping physically, he's not really doing that much. It's the near total cessation of physical activity. The sleep that the shofar is trying to wake people up from is the unending and the unceasing run of physical activity. It's because people don't stop. They one thing follows another and they don't have time to think, so their higher faculties enter a slumbered state. Which means that whereas when you wish to wake up someone from a physical sleep, you want to take them from a state of inaction to action. But when you wish to wake someone up from a spiritual sleep, you want to actually take them from a state of ongoing action to a moment of inaction, as if to say, just stop for a while. And there are certain faculties that haven't been heard from for a long time. They represent values that have been pushed to the side a little bit. Those should come back to the center. That's the measure of the waking up that the shofar is talking about. The shofar is addressing people who are essentially walking in their sleep the whole time, even when they're awake. And when we consider the matter, we'll appreciate that the question as to which side of the person is awake, the physical side, the temporal side, or the spiritual side, or the elevated side, is exactly the same as another expression of the question of how the day is to be counted. For someone for whom the physical side is awake and the spiritual side is slumbering, so for he lays primacy on the physical aspects of life, and the implications for the way to count the day is, in physical terms, first comes the day, then comes the night. But someone who's had an awakening, someone who has come to reclaim the spiritual aspects as being the center of what life is all about, so that he will now reconfigure the way he counts the day. If really this is the part of man that should be awake, then the night comes before the day. And the way that helps us is because when we come back to the shofar that was sounded, it's a delicate point, but I believe it's very meaningful. When we come back to the shofar that was sounded, when Moshe goes up to Har Sinai to get the second set of luchos, they sound the shofar, and the message is, Moshe's going up now. Don't make the same mistake. And our question was, well, they could still make the same mistake after. You never know. Just today, is it part of the count? Is it not part of the count? If any other instrument had been used to spread the message, that question would still be there. But if the message is spread through the shofar isn't just saying, all be aware that Moshe's going up now. The shofar is saying, Moshe's going up now, and wake up. Because if you do wake up and you understand what's primary in life, you will also understand that the way that the days are to be counted is accordingly, which means first the night and then the day. That's the shofardika way of counting a day. And today is only half a day because the night's already passed. And you will know how to count the 40 days. So it does address the heart of the matter for those that are receptive to hearing the shofar. And that's their nisayon, the second time round, a nisayon which the Jewish people passed. So with this newer appreciation as to the historical background to the sounding of the shofar, it gives us further appreciation to the shofar every year. Moshe doesn't go up the mountain every year, but the message that accompanied Moshe going up the mountain that year is necessary and relevant every year, and not only on the first day of Elul, but for the entirety of Elul. When we think of Elul, and we should think of Elul, we think of it as a time of preparation for Rosh Hashanah. That's a bit of an abstract concept. It could mean anything. And like many things that could mean anything, it has been in danger of meaning nothing. We prepare. How should we prepare? Well, we should do tshuva, but then we're not sure what to do. How much tshuva should we do? All of it? What if we finish doing tshuva before Rosh Hashanah? Then what should we do? We have to take a machzor back and hopefully get a refund because we finished. As my father used to say in Elul, repent now, avoid the rush. So, that's it. It's tshuva, the same thing that we do in Rosh Hashanah, just kind of do it for 30 days. So what's the difference between Rosh Hashanah and Elul? It's a good thing to do tshuva, but you should do tshuva before Elul also. I think the most meaningful way to describe what Elul is, is that Elul is about preparing the climate for Rosh Hashanah. I mean, the concepts that we'll be focusing on Rosh Hashanah are things that if we're unfamiliar with, they will not impact as much. Everything from Malchios and Zichronos and all of those things. In a sense, the 30 days beforehand are about reclaiming the lexicon of these terms, about making the weather again, that they will be received and absorbed during that time. Elul, therefore, is a time of reminding ourselves what's important. What should be primary, what should be secondary. It's a preparation because we become re-aware of things as a prelude to Rosh Hashanah. That's the wake-up. And that is why we blow the shofar before Rosh Hashanah. But once Rosh Hashanah is finished, we don't blow the shofar anymore. Because Rosh Hashanah, as distinct from Yom Kippur, as we have begun to say during the days of Elul, in the morning, and the evening, or the afternoon, depending on one's minhag, the David Hashem Uri V'Yishi. Now, what's the shaifus of that chapter of Tehillim to Elul? The Medrash tells us, Medrash Tehillim, Medrash Sochato, that the two terms Uri and Yishi correspond to the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim. Uri, my light, for Rosh Hashanah, V'Yishi, my salvation, B'yom HaKippurim. And what that means is that Rosh Hashanah is not a formal day of tshuva yet. As we know, there's no vidui, and there's no Hashem Nebagadnu, and there's no Al-Chait. There's all sorts of other things. Because Rosh Hashanah is about seeing things in the correct light. That's Ori. There can't be meaningful tshuva without that. It's worth a day, or 2 days. Once one sees things clearly, the way is paved for Yishi on Yom HaKippurim. And therefore, the wake-up of the shofar during Elul is preparation for the clarity of Rosh Hashanah. As we begin to remember things and remember what's important, all of that is preparing for Rosh Hashanah. Once we do that, we don't blow the shofar anymore. We just then set about doing tshuva during the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. So, I believe that this gives some deeper meaning for us during that moment, really, during Elul. It's just a moment every morning of those four sounds to have a bit of a sense of what they mean to be saying and how they contribute to preparing the ground for Rosh Hashanah that is to come, Mitzvah Hashem, in a few weeks' time. And with that, we open Parsha Shoftim. The Shoftim begins by addressing the Shoftim, Shotrim. And there is a very interesting mitzvah, or aveira actually, prohibition, which comes in the second pasuk of the Parsha. And that is the Isser of Shochat, of accepting a bribe. The Torah says, Lo Sateh Mishpat, do not, this is in Perek Tet Zayin, Pasuk Yotes, Lo Sateh Mishpat, do not pervert justice, Lo Sakir Ponim, do not favor people, V'lo Tikach Shochat, and do not take a bribe, Ki HaShochat Ye'aver Einei Chachamim, it will blind the eyes of the wise. It doesn't mean you're not wise, you are wise, but you're a blind wise person. V'Yisalef Dibrei Tzadikim, it can falsify the words of the righteous. That's the Isser of Shochat. Now what's important to establish, as Rashi does, because when we think about taking a bribe, we shouldn't know from such things, but unfortunately we hear of such things. When we think of taking a bribe, it's you know from the outset that this person isn't really right, but he passes on a few dollars and then he becomes right. You know from the outset that what you're doing isn't right, otherwise he wouldn't need to bribe you. But actually, which of course is usur. But the Torah's prohibition, as Rashi will tell us, against taking a bribe, is not only when you're consciously distorting things. You know he's in the wrong, but money speaks, and then no one else has a voice, and you adjust things accordingly. No. What if he comes from the outset, one of the sides, and says, listen, I appreciate what you're doing. I would like to show my appreciation, give you another $100 or so. I'm sure you'll do the right thing. And if you, I'd just like to encourage you. If you decide against me, that's okay. I'm not going to ask for my money back. So from the outset, he is not telling you or even demanding of you that you swing the mishpat in his favor. He's just saying, here's a bribe. I'm sure you'll do what's right. And whatever that is, I accept it. That's the isser. That is to say, even that is also. Rashi says, "V'lo tikach shochad." Actually, this prohibition appears twice in the Torah. The first time is in Parshas Mishpatim. The second time here. The first time round, Rashi is slightly more elaborate. Here he speaks very tersely. "V'lo tikach shochad," says Rashi, "afilu lishpot tzedek." Don't accept a bribe from one of them, even with the statement of judge the case justly. Even that's not acceptable. Rashi's source is the Gemara in Maseches Ksubos in Daf Kuf Hei Amud Beis, and the Gemara says it must be so, because if the subtotal of the Torah's prohibition against accepting a bribe is when you will do so to knowingly vindicate one of the sides that you are aware that he is in the wrong, so then you don't need an isser against taking a bribe. You can't do that even without money. I mean, adding money is not going to make it any more mutter. The very opening of the pasuk, Lo Sateh Mishpat, do not pervert the course of justice. Ever. Even for free. So if it's already a prohibition that you can't do it without payment, so there's no way that the additional prohibition, and don't take a bribe, is to do that thing that it's prohibited to do even without a bribe. That's why, says the Gemara, the prohibition against taking a bribe is even if he does not demand of you or ostensibly expect from you that you will swing things in his favor, he just wants you to judge the right thing. That's the chiddush of lo tikach shochad. So it's the redundancy. It's already been spoken for to knowingly pervert justice. Other meforshim, interestingly, come to the same conclusion that it's even in order to do the right thing, to reach the right conclusions, it's forbidden to take a bribe. It's organic. I mean, it's inherent within the verse, because the pasuk goes on to explain why you can't take a bribe. What are the words of the pasuk? V'lo tikach shochad. Why not? Ki ha-shochad ya'aver einecha chum, because once you take a shochad, you'll be blind. You'll be partial to one of the sides. Now, that pasuk is addressing a person who thinks that he will reach the right decision. The Torah is telling you he won't. So clearly the prohibition is for someone who wants to reach the right decision, not who's consciously already from the outset reaching a wrong decision. That's not about the money blinding him. He's it's saying even if you would like to see justice through, you will not be able to once you've taken a bribe from one of the sides. Ye'aver einei chacham. Then the pasuk says, V'salef divrei tzadikim, and it will falsify the words of the righteous. These final words of the pasuk are harder to explain than the original ones, than the earlier ones. Ye'aver einei chachamim blinds the eyes of the wise. Okay, we understand that, and that's been said. What is this second clause? V'yisaleif divrei tzadikim. They'll falsify the words of tzadikim. Who are the tzadikim here? Well, the chachamim in the earlier clause, they are the dayanim. Even if the judges are chachamim, they will be blind. Are the tzadikim also the dayanim? Say the mefarshim. Unlikely, because if they're taking bribes, which is a prohibition, they're not tzadikim. So who are the tzadikim whose words will be falsified? It seems that the tzadikim are the litigants who are in the right. Somehow the pasuk is saying once a person takes a bribe, the other party that didn't participate, although parenthetically it is not acceptable to take a bribe from both sides, as if to say, well, you know, the conservation of matter will kind of keep burning back on an equilibrium, that's not okay. But in the standard case where he's taken a bribe from one side, even if the other side is right, the non-bribing party, he's the tzaddik, you'll falsify his words. Whatever he says will come out wrong. Whatever he says to vindicate himself will end up incriminating him because you took a bribe from the other side. But if that's all that it means, it's still somewhat problematic because it seems to be a restatement of the earlier phrase. The earlier phrase says, Ya'aver einei chachamim, it will blind the eyes of the wise, meaning you're blind to anything that doesn't fit in with the agenda of the one who gave you the bribe, including, even if the other side is right, you'll falsify his words. You won't recognize the truth. It seems to be a restatement of Ya'aver einei chachamim. And maybe it is. But the Vilna Gaon, in his Perush Aderes Eliyahu, says something very interesting. V'yisalef divrei tzadikim, when the Torah is telling you just how much damage can be caused by taking a bribe in terms of corrupting the judicial system, the Beis Din system, it goes beyond the case that you took the bribe. For a simple reason. The case in which you took the bribe, you were partial to one side, and you completely dismissed and refuted and refused to recognize the claims and the arguments and the evidence of the other side. If you go through with that, you have created legal precedent for disallowing that type of claim. You weren't open to it. So what if in a week's time, you're back on the panel, and no one's bribing you now, but someone comes with a valid claim, but legal precedent has already been established in your court that is not a valid claim. Why? Because last week you took a bribe and you couldn't see it. This week, even when you can, you'll have no choice but to reject it. And mitzvah gereres mitzvah, and it will reverberate throughout all of these cases. You'll have created, thrown spanners in the works of the judicial system. That, says the Gaon, is why it says, v'yisalef divrei tzadikim, you'll be forced to falsify the words of worthy words and valid claims even way beyond this one occasion that you took a bribe. That's why it can never have entry into the court in the first place. Very interesting in terms of parshanut. Now, we mentioned that this prohibition of lo tikach shochad appears twice in the Torah, earlier in Mishpatim and here in Shoftim, it's almost identical. The Shochad Lotikach, it can blind the judge, but there is one significant shift in phraseology, which Mefarshim speak about, and that is, in our pasuk it says, Ki Hashochad Ye'aver Einei Chachamim. It will blind the eyes of the wise. In Parshas Mishpatim, Shmos Perek Kaf Gimel Pasuk Ches, it says, Ki Hashochad Ye'aver Pikchim. It will blind the eyes of the wise. Who's a pikeach? A pikeach is a wise person. It's true. But a pikeach and a chacham are not exactly the same thing. Why is it that the Torah in one occasion talks about blinding chachamim and the other occasion talks about blinding the eyes of pikeachim? And the Vilna Gaon explains that the reason why is because in order for a dayan to successfully adjudicate a case and give the correct verdict, he really needs to be two things. He needs to be what's called a chacham on the one hand and a pikeach on the other hand. What's a chacham and what's a pikeach? A chacham, says the Vilna Gaon, is someone who knows the halacha in any given case. He is a baki in Choshen Mishpat of Shulchan Aruch, and he knows Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, and Sanhedrin. He knows every halachic response to any halachic claim. He still might not reach the correct decision, because court cases involve people, and people sometimes lie. And it should be up to the judge to tell whether those that are giving evidence are telling the truth, to the extent that he can. But there are sometimes obvious cues, the way that they're talking, the words that they use, and whatever it may be. He should use his discretion to pursue the matter further. It could be that halachically, the cross-examination is satisfied. He asked all the right questions, they gave all the right answers, but he should have a chush. You should have an intuition that it may be in place to ask another two or three pertinent questions. And sometimes the whole thing unravels over that. Who can know? A pikeach will know. He needs to be savvy in that role. Both are necessary. And the Gaon says, that's why the Gemara tells us, it's a well-known phrase throughout Chazal, emes la'amito. The Gemara says in Shabbos and Daf Yud, it extols the virtues of a dayan called dayan hadan din emes la'amito. Truth in its truth. Well. What is truth in its truth? If it's true, it must be true. Says the Gaon, no. Sometimes it's emes and it's not true, because he got the right Shulchan Aruch answer, but he didn't realize it was not appropriate for the situation. He should have pressed further. He should have tried a different angle, and therefore the only judge, the only dayan who gets the full yeshar koach from the Gemara, is not only is it emes, but it's also la'amito. He said the right thing, and it was right to say the right thing. And this becomes the legacy of all the gedolim who have sat on a bezdin. They've had to contend with situations where emes is not enough. One needs emes la'amito. I'm reminded in this vein of a very interesting story that took place in the Beis Din of the Maril Diskin, Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin, who was the Dayan in Brisk. And the Beis Din there, I mean, they were responsible for everything, Choshen Mishpat, also Evan Ezer, Lo Alino, if a divorce happened, they had to take care of it. What do they need? They need the ksuba, certain questions need to be. Back in the day, when people come, you don't know who they are, but you have to be able to accept certain credentials. If a married couple turns up with a ksuba and they know enough, so then that's them. So there was a couple that turned up to the Beis Din in Brisk. They didn't seem to be your traditional Jewish couple. They seemed to be a bit more on the modern side, but what can one do? You can't throw people out of Beis Din in terms of the way that they dress. And they're saying, we've come to the conclusion that we need to have a divorce. Who are you? He's so-and-so, she's so-and-so. Do you have any credentials? Here's a ksuba. It's just not working out. They were so, it's seemingly estranged from what it means to be in a Beis Din, they even brought their poodle with them, which was constantly disrupting the proceedings, it was going from one to the other. They didn't somehow seem to be that serious, but they answered all the right questions, and when he was answering the questions, so the dog went to her, when she was answering the questions, the dog went to him. No one had ever seen anything like this before, but again, what are you going to do? You can't dismiss them just because they own a dog. And everything was in order. And they're about to write the get. Mariel Diskin says, wait. Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin. We'll do it tomorrow. Now, strictly speaking, there's no reason to defer till tomorrow. I mean, everything is in order today. What will happen today and tomorrow? The other Dayanim looked at the Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin. No one understood why. And he didn't explain why. Said, we should wait. We should wait till tomorrow. So the couple looked at each other. Wait till tomorrow. They go back. They're in a hotel. They'll come back the next day. They come back the next morning. Everything's in order. And they're about to write the get. And someone runs into the Besdin in Brisk. Frantic. He's been running. He's been traveling. He just arrived. And he said, that man, I'm the husband. I mean, he's an adulterer. This man has been carrying on with my wife, and they stole my ksuba. And then they can just go to another town and pass themselves off as that because they want to get together. They want me, her to be divorced from me, so that they can actually get married. So of course everything changed at that point. There was no divorce, and the original couple were thrown out of the Besdin. But this was highly peculiar. And everyone's looking at Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin. I mean, there's no way that he could have known, unless he has Ruach HaKodesh, which is always possible. But they said, well, Yilamdeinu Rabbeinu. How did you know to wait? I mean, what were you waiting for? So the Maral Diskin said, it's very simple. The dog. While we were going through all of the questions yesterday, you may not have noticed, the dog was going between one and the other. One thing I can guarantee you, if this was a real husband and wife who were seeking a divorce, by this stage, the dog would have chosen a side. Dogs are very sensitive. They know one of the sides would have claimed the dog, he would have shown loyalty to one side and enmity towards the other. If he's so Hamish with both of them, playing with each one back and forth, one thing's for sure, this is not a couple seeking a divorce. I didn't know what was going on, I thought it was kedai to wait. And that was the mice with the Rishu Leib Diskin. So it's fascinating that you're not going to find halachas like that in Shulchan Aruch. But the din would have been a din emes, not la'amito. It would have been a disaster. That's the pikrus that the Vilna Gaon is talking about. Hafle v'afel. Let's conclude by taking a look at the section at the end of Parsha Shoftim, the section of Egla Arufa. Egla Rufa has many unusual aspects to it. As we know, the background to Egla Rufa is a tragic situation. Someone is found, he's been killed, and no one knows. Lo noda mihi kahu, no one knows who did it. And pending them finding out, there's a certain procedure which is called Egla Rufa. They take the calf and then they kill it, and there's a great deal of discussion amongst the Meforshim as to the different aspects of this mitzvah. Who presides over this? The Pasuk states, or just to read the Pasuk from the beginning, Perikav Aleph Pasuk, Aleph Ki Matzei Chalal Ba'adama, if a body is found on the ground, Asher Hashem Lokecha, No Sinecha L'Rishta, No Fel Basode, is there in a field, Lo No Dam Mihiko, no one knows. So they do not just leave it like that, an open investigation, something else happens in the interim. The Egla Rufa, and it's presided upon by the Besdin, the nearest Besdin, Pasuk Beis, V'yatzu zikenecha v'shoftecha. The zikenim, the shoftim, the judges and the elders, they go out, and who brings the Egla Rufa? The nearest town. U'modadu el ha'arim asher sevivu zechala. They measure around, and the one that's nearest, that's the one that has to a degree, take achrayas for what happened. But important to note, as the Gemara tells us, because the Besdin needs to represent the town, we only measure from towns that have a Besdin. So it could be that there's a place that's closer, it could be a village, but if it doesn't have a resident Besdin, so you can't have people that say what needs to be said, and therefore the closest town is the one that's reckoned as the closest town with the Beis Din. The Rambam, interestingly, in Hilchos Ratzeach, Perek Tes, Halacha Dalet, says that the only type of town, city, that can be within the measuring field for Egla Rufa is a town that has a Beis Din of 23 Dayanim. Now that's very significant, because a Beis Din doesn't need to have 22 Dayanim. There are certain things that you need 23 for, but Egla Rufa, you don't need 23 Dayanim, you need however many, 3 or 5 or whatever it is. 3 is an entirely acceptable Beis Din if they're qualified Dayanim. And Mefarshim are wondering, how does the Rambam know? Well, where does he get it from that when the Gemara says, when we say that it's only a town that has a Beis Din that's measured in terms of the distance from the body, it's specifically a Beis Din, a town that has a Beis Din of 23. It's something of a mystery. The Rambam didn't say it, of course. But the Ziv explains. As we move further and they do this whole procedure with the Egla Rufa, then there's something that they say. The Anuv Amru, Pasuk Zayin, Maftir. Pasuk Zayin, the Perkaf Aleph. The Anuv Amru, this is the Zakenim, the Dayanim. Yadeinu lo shachru es adam hazeh. Our hands did not spill this blood. The Einenu lo ra'u. And we didn't see. Now, at face value, the Torah is demanding that the Beis Din declare that they didn't kill him. But of course, Rashi, quoting from the Gemara in Masechet Sota, they're not the suspects. I mean, they've been in the Beis Din the whole time. No one's suspecting them. What does it mean? Rashi says, "V'chi alsa aleiv shezikne Beis Din shovchei damim heim." That's what it's all about. They've got to clear their name. No one suspects them. So what's this declaration? We didn't spill this blood. What it means is, Ella. L'ra'inuhu patarnuhu b'lo mezonos u'lo levia. What they're saying is, we're in charge of the town. We didn't see him leave town and just let him go without making sure that he has provisions for the way, that someone accompanies him a little bit of the way. That the Beis Din can do. In other words, what Rashi from the Gemara, and it's such an obvious question, who would suspect them of bloodshed that they need to clear their name? So what does the pasuk mean? What it means is that no one's suspecting them directly, but even indirectly. And what's this got to do with Yodeinu Lo Shachru? I heard from my father's atzal many years ago that what they're saying is that perhaps if he'd left town with food and with accompaniment, who knows if he may have been able to fend off an attacker. Maybe he left town miserable. He doesn't know where his next meal is coming from. No one noticed him. No one cares about him. That's the person who's prone to damage. You never know. Maybe had he left with buoyed spirits, the attacker would never have started up with him. You never know. That's how Rashi explains. Yadeinu lo shafku es adam hazeh. Interestingly, the Talmud Yerushalmi in Sota explains this declaration differently. Very differently. When the Beis Din say, we're not responsible for this, and of course our question is, well, no one thinks you are. What do they mean by that? Why do they have to clear their name? What they mean is, and what they need to be able to say is, we have not released a convicted killer from our jurisdiction. That's how the Beis Din could be responsible for him. If they had a killer in the Beis Din and they did not execute justice but rather let him go, maybe he's a killer. And where do you think he comes from? We don't know. But if you do know, if for whatever reason they let a killer on the loose, then they are responsible. They provided the murderer to all intents and purposes. To a degree. So different than the Bavli. That's what they need to be prepared to say. Anyone that we are aware of that's a killer, we have dealt with. Who is this person? We don't know. It's a tragedy, but we're not derelict in this respect. That's a lot to ponder. Says the Netziv, when you think about it, not only is there a vast difference in parshanut between these two explanations of the declaration, we didn't let him go without food or accompaniment, we didn't let a killer on the loose, that's a very different perushim, but there could also be halachic nafkemina, halachic ramifications. Why? Because what type of bezdin do you need in order to make this declaration? According to the Bavli, the bezdin represents those that are in charge of the town. We should have given him food, we should have given him water. What type of bezdin can and should have to make a declaration like that? Any bezdin, even of three, they're also responsible for the city. If that's all the city has, a bezdin of three. But if the understanding of their declaration that they need to say is, we did not release a convicted killer, that can only be made by a bezdin that has the ability to convict and execute a killer. And that's a bezdin of 23. And that, says the Netziv, is the source of the Rambam. That's where the Rambam says, you only take into account the towns that have a bezdin of 23. Because the Rambam understands the declaration of Lo Yadeinu Lo Shafcha Adam Hazeh, like the Yerushalmi. And therefore, only those that are eligible are Bati Din of 23. That's why they're only in the camp. Dvarim Nifloim. In the end, I remember, I heard this many years ago from my Rebbe, Reb Chaim Volkin Shlita, in the name of his father, Reb Shmuel David Volkin. For we focused, in terms of the declaration, Yadeinu lo shafcha es adam hazeh, we're not responsible, and which we've explained in a number of ways. And then they say, Ve'eineinu lo ra'u, and our eyes didn't see. What? No one, or not no one, there's less emphasis on that second phrase. Everyone focuses on Yadeinu lo shafcha, what does that mean? But what does Eineinu lo ra'u mean? Presumably it's subsumed within Yadeinu lo shafcha. And Reb Shmuel David Volkin said that this, as much as the first phrase, Yadeinu lo shafchu, is the best in clearing their name, but Eineinu lo ra'u is no longer clearing their name. Eineinu lo ra'u is a confession. As if to say, we're not responsible. We did everything right, we didn't do anything wrong. Yadeinu lo shafchu. But it didn't end there, because something happened. After all is said and done, and everyone is beseder, we didn't see it coming. We didn't. There was no foresight. There was no notion that something like this could happen. And what the Bezdin are saying is, there should have been. We recognize we should have been more vigilant. There should have been more protection. There should have been more of a sense of security. So with all that's said and done, no one can indict them. But they themselves, it's a moment of cheshbon nefesh, really. But eveneinu l'ra. Reb Shmuel David actually said this to someone. And it comes back, in a sense, to our remarks at the beginning of the shiur this evening. Certain mistakes, misunderstandings, lack of information could be avoided. He suffered the bereavement of one of his parents, I don't remember which one, Reb Shmuel David. And he met a friend, lo aleinu. And he met a friend, and the friend says, you didn't come to the shiva. He says to the friend. So his friend says, I'm sorry, I didn't know. And Shmuel David said, how did you not know? And he directed him to the end of Shoftim. Sometimes it's not acceptable not to know. If you're attentive, if you're sensitive, if your eyes are open, you'll know. And if you don't know, maybe you should have known. So it's a new vista, really, in terms of not every time we don't know or we misunderstood. Again, is it pure? Couldn't have been avoided. Sometimes we should know. I believe these are relevant sentiments, certainly to these days of Elul. Not only ben adam lamakom, also ben adam lachaveiro. Sometimes ben adam lachaveiro gets pushed to the side a little bit. We're on the way to do tshuva, and there's people in the way. Sometimes they get trampled on a little bit because tshuva is the mitzvah of the day. But as we know, the Bali and Musa were all the more sensitive to other people during these days. That's also part of tshuva. The well-known Rosh HaTevis of Elul, Anila Dodiva Dodili, is primarily Ben Adam Lamokom, Anila Dodiva Dodili. But the Mefarshim point out there's another set of Rosh HaTevis for Elul. It's from Megillas Esther, Ish L'Re'ehu U'Matonis Le'Evyonim. That's also Rosh HaTevis, Elul, Aleph Lamed Vav Lamed. And the point is that as we're looking to be our best, and to get back to our best, During the season of tshuva, part of that is to be more attentive, to be looking with brighter eyes, and to be listening with a closer hearing, so that we shouldn't say we didn't know. We should know if something happens. We should know that we've been sensitive, and with this, we'll prepare optimally for the days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Aleinu L'tova. We'll leave it over there for this evening.